Hi everyone, my name's Harry, I'm an addict.
Hi Harry.
Very nice to be here and very nice to be asked, and thanks to Fred for his share, I really enjoyed that. I like what he was saying about the hugging thing, standing in front of a door and not letting anybody go by, you know, for a hug. I got clean in Australia some time ago, and I had a real problem around hugging. I didn't really want to be hugged, and I didn't really want to hug. I was quite happy to shake your hands, you know what I mean? But over the years I've been clean, I've kind of learnt how to hug. And I was lucky enough to have been in Orlando last week for the World Convention. And the first day there, I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd just arrived sort of a few hours earlier, and I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning through jet lag, and I decided to make my way towards the convention center. I knew it wasn't gonna be open, so I plotted up in this kind of greasy spoon called Denny's over there. Had a pile of basically fats, and you know, it was just this plate full of food, and there's so much food that there was like two plates to put it on. So I'm sitting in there in any case, and these guys walk in about 7 o'clock, and they've got lanyards on, okay, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, they're from the convention, so I'll go and practice my hugging skills. So I went over there, and I said, are you for the convention? They said, yeah, we're here for the convention. So I said, stand up, we'll give you a hug. So I gave these two guys a hug. And then I said to their women, get up, and I gave them a hug as well. And I sat down with them at the table to have a cup of coffee with them. It turned out I was in the wrong convention. So I'm hugging these guys' women. Probably thinking, the fuck's this guy? This British company is hugging our women, you know, giving them a big strong hug, you know what I mean? Oh dear. Anyhow, had a great time. I really enjoyed it. It was a real privilege, one of the privileges of being clean. You were talking about travel, that's one of the things that I love doing as well. And, you know, I'm going to share a little bit about my using. I know that kind of worries some people. I often hear people say, we don't need to share about our using because we all know where we've come from. But it's not about me today, it's not about you guys today, it's about the newcomers today, as far as I'm concerned, you know what I mean? And if I hadn't got the identification of the using, I'm not sure I would have stayed clean, to be honest with you. Because I'm looking, as you said, I'm looking around you guys now, and to be quite honest, none of you look like addicts, you know? And none of you do. None of you look like what I looked like when I first turned up at my first meeting. And I turned up at my first meeting, I hadn't washed for a long time. Hard though it is to believe looking at me now, I was skinny then, you know what I mean? I just was skin and bones, and I had a denim jacket on that I'd cut a hole in the sleeve just here so I didn't have to roll my sleeve up to hit up, you know what I mean? My hair was dirty, my hair was matted, and I looked like an addict. And the reason I was at that meeting at the beginning was, you know, I'd arrived there at rock bottom, but that was pure coincidence. I'd heard nothing about recovery. I didn't believe in recovery. I didn't believe that anybody got clean. You know, I didn't need to come to an NA meeting to know that we ended up in jail, or we ended up in institutions, or we ended up dead. That was my experience of people who I used with. That's where we ended up. So I didn't really need to come to a meeting. And I'd given up trying, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? I used to make those promises the night before that tomorrow was going to be different. And you know what? I've never made promises like that before or since. I meant that promise with every fiber of my body. Tomorrow is going to be different. And tomorrow was never any different, other than I needed more money to get together more drugs. And that's what it was like, you know. Believe us, you know, in our addiction, we were slowly committing suicide, it says in our literature. That didn't bother me, you know what I mean? I didn't think about suicide because all my thinking was about getting together money to get together the drugs. It was just sheer hell. And it was a life worse than death. I didn't care at all. And I really believe if you use drugs like I use drugs, then you stood at the edge of the abyss, and there is life worse than death, you know, looking into it. So I didn't believe in recovery. In fact, if you'd said to me about recovery, at the time I was using out in Australia, it was very difficult to get onto a methadone program, which is what I thought, if I could just get onto a methadone program. But they didn't do methadone, very little methadone at that time. And I thought, you know, so if you'd say, if you'd asked me about recovery, whatever that meant, I would have said, yeah, a chemist that supplies me with three bottles of codeine linked to a day, you know what I mean? And then I would have thought that's me making a success of my life, you know, if I could just find that chemist, you know, and they wouldn't, like I said, they wouldn't sell me aspirin, let alone anything else, when they saw me coming in the door. So I found out about narcotics. So I really, you know, at the end of my using, I hadn't started like that. You know, to be honest with you, when I started using drugs, they were the solution. That wasn't the solution. I thought I'd found the solution in drugs. That's exactly what happened. When I picked up my first drug, I thought, hello, here we are. I've arrived, you know. And to be honest with you guys, if they still did that, if that's still how I felt, then I would still be doing it today. I didn't stop using because the hand of God came down and said, you know what, Harry, drugs are bad. You've got to stop using. You know what I mean? I stopped using. I didn't stop using because I woke up with a hangover one day and thought, oof, you know, I needed to be ground into the dirt for me to sort of get that willingness to do the one thing that I wanted to do, the one thing that I thought was the solution that actually turned out to be the lie. You know, but I still didn't understand that. I still didn't understand anything about total abstinence or anything like that, you know. And I just thought, and at that time, I got clean in 1985. And in 1984, which was my worst year of using, there was a lot of AIDS was around at that time. You know, it was just discovered. You know, so a lot of my friends, a lot of the guys I was using with were dying around me, you know. And I remember being handed the phone by somebody at one time. I can't really remember who it was now. It was a woman who handed me the phone and said, look, these people want to speak to you. And I said, well, who? I'm immediately suspicious. Who wants to speak to me? Are they do-gooders or what have you? You know what I mean? And she said, no, they're called Narcotics Anonymous. Now, I'd never heard of Narcotics Anonymous before, okay? But I have to be honest with you, as a using addict, the name interested me. It had the word narcotics in it, had the word anonymous in it. So the first time I spoke to this guy, I still remember the guy's name, a guy called Gordon. He was the guy on the other end of the hotline. I said, Gordon, I didn't listen to what he had, so I just said, Gordon, can you tell me how to get onto a methadone program? And today I am so pleased that the man didn't say, whoa, you're not going to find methadone in an NA meeting, Harry. He didn't say that. He didn't say, oh, this is a program of complete abstinence from all drugs. He didn't say you're going to walk in and find the word God on the wall. You're going to find the word spiritual on the wall, prayer, meditation, and all that kind of stuff. He didn't tell me that. He just said, well, yeah, come to a meeting tomorrow. So I turn up on my first NA meeting expecting to be served up methadone. And because I thought there was going to be methadone there, I was a good half an hour early as well. So I'm sitting outside with my denim jacket on, the blood and everything like that, you know. And this guy came up to me, this guy came up to me and he stuck his hat, he looked at me, he said, are you here for the NA meeting? And I said, well, I might be. Why, what's it to you? And he stuck his hand out. He said, well, my name's Derek and I'm an addict. And he shook my hand, okay. And I looked at this guy and I thought, this is not like any addict I've ever seen before. For a start, this addict had a suntan. Have you ever heard of such a thing? An addict with a suntan. You know, the last end of my using was done in kind of darkened rooms, you know. The sun would be shining outside, but I was as white as a sheet, you know. And so he had a suntan, and he also had a watch on. And my watch was the first thing years and years ago before that went down the hock shop, a long time before that, you know, had a watch on. And not only that, the biggest thing was he was smiling. This guy was smiling and he was laughing. So I shake his hand. And I'm thinking, you know, and he goes, and then other people come in. And it wasn't a big meeting, that meeting. But everybody who came in looked far too happy, far too clean, you know, far too well-dressed for me to think that they were addicts. So if they'd started the meeting and just started the meeting by talking about this strange thing called recovery, I've gone in there now and I've looked at them, I thought, oh, yeah, amateurs, you know what I mean? The only person who looked like a junkie was me, okay? But they all did a kind of mini version of what I'm doing at the moment, what it was like, how they came into NA, and what this strange thing called recovery was like. And you know what? An hour and a half later, after that meeting started, the lie was dead for me. Once a junkie, always a junkie. Because I could not believe I was sitting in a room with half a dozen people who'd found a way out. Not just one person, but half a dozen people. And I knew from the way they shared, I knew from the identification I got that these people were like me. And I could have found differences if I wanted to. There were differences. Some of those guys had used, I came in when I was 27, and some of these guys had used a lot longer than I had. Some of them hadn't used as much as I had. Some of them hadn't used like I used, had different drugs. And it doesn't really matter, you know, but the identification I got, I can't remember whether they said look for the different similarities or differences, I can't remember. But having said that, I'm still sitting in this meeting waiting for the methadone to be served up, okay? So they come into the meeting, and I just had this fantasy, you know, what it's like when you're using, you're just insane, aren't you? And I had this fantasy there'd be this polished oak bar like an old English pub, and they'd pump up my 120 ml of methadone and say, there you go, Harry, on your way, you know? And they gave me a cup of coffee, and then by this time I'd seen the word God on the ball, and I'm thinking, oh. they're going to start. The next thing they're going to do is bring out the tambourines and the guitars and sit around singing "Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam" or something like that. You know. So when I heard their shares, when they did that, you know what I mean? I knew that that was. I knew that these people had knew where I was, and not only had they knew where I was, they'd found a way out. You know. And that was brilliant to get that at that first meeting, honestly, you know. And I honestly think if I'd arrived maybe a year or two earlier, I'm not sure I would have stayed clean, because I'm not sure I would have been rock bottom at that particular time, if the truth be known. You know, I might have thought I still had another use up in me. I don't know. I came when I was, you know, anybody who'd seen me beforehand would have seen a succession of rock bottoms. But for me, you know, the shit had been kicked out of me by that time. I knew that this was over. I knew that the party was over, you know. So I turned up, like I said, I didn't get clean from that first meeting. I started going to meetings for the next month, and I went to meetings regularly, you know, at least one a day at that for that next month, still using. Because I still thought that I knew best. I was going to be the guy who was going to drink. I was going to be the guy who was going to smoke spliff. I was going to be the guy who was going to drop sleepers, you know what I mean? Because when you're detoxing, you can't sleep. And if your depression was as bad as my depression, then you would also need to take the handfuls of antidepressants I was taking as well. So that's what I was saying. And nobody said, "Oi, Harry, you can't stay around." I'd come into meetings, I'd literally gouch out on my person in the lap. They'd push me up again, and then I'd gouch out on somebody else's lap. You know what I mean? And, you know, and yet, like I said, nobody said, "You can't come," you know? And it hadn't occurred to me that my best effort, my best thinking, Harry's best thinking, was the reason I was there in the first place. So why I was still listening to my head, I don't know. But in that, and that was probably the worst part of my using, to be honest with you, because up until that point, I didn't think there was a way out. By the end of that first month of coming to Narcotics Anonymous, I'd seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of recovering addicts. You know, it was a big fellowship out there. Hadn't been going very long, I'd only been going for about 6 or 7 years, but I'd go to meetings with, you know, 200 people at the meeting, and they would be, that would be one of the like 6 or 7 meetings that were there at the time. So every time I went to a meeting, I was confronted with a solution. Here is a, there is a way out if you want it. It wasn't forced on me or anything. People would come up to me and ask if I'd been out in the research department again. I like that gentle nature of things, you know what I mean? And at the end of that month, I found myself yet again in a toilet, after 13, 14 hours of getting together the money to get together the drugs, in a toilet in King's Cross in Sydney, with a needle in my arm, lying in my own piss and in my own vomit, with my head on the porcelain bowl, and I'm thinking, this is the good part of the day. This is the part of the day I've got all that money together to get all those drugs together. This is Harry actually enjoying himself. I don't know what it was about that, but something at that point thought, you know, there's got to be more to life than this. Has to be more to life than this. And you know what? I think at that particular point around then, I took the cotton wool out of my ears and stuck it in my mouth, which was an expression we had in Australia. I don't know whether we talk about it here, but you know, I took that, I did that, and rather than saying, "I know how to do this," I got those Leicester telephone numbers I got in my first meeting, and I started phoning somebody up, people up, until I found somebody. You know what I mean? And that was my first call for help. And February the 1st, 1985 was my clean day, and I haven't had to use since. So, you know, and I just went into early recovery, and what a fantastic thing that was, you know, just right from the beginning, really. You know, I've got to be honest with you, you know, I knew, listen, I hear a lot of people talk about the steps, where they work the steps, people go into treatment, get given steps, and they write the steps, et cetera, what have you. Me, I didn't want to have anything to do with the steps when I came in, because they had the word God in, they had the word spiritual in, so I didn't want anything to do with that. And people didn't say, "You have to do them." They didn't twist my arm, they just said, "Keep coming back to meetings," you know. And that's what I did, I kept coming back to meetings. But if you'd said to me, after being clean for, say, 60 days or something like that, "Why are you here, Harry?" You know, I would have told you that I couldn't use drugs. I could have told you that one was too many and 1,000 never enough, that's why I wasn't picking up again. I could have told you that it was the first one that was going to put me back on the merry-go-round again. I knew that. And why was that important? That was important to me because if I did that stuff, my life was a fucking mess. It was a chaotic, unbelievable, you know, morass of shit, basically. You know, and I that happened when I was using. Now, if that's not step one, I don't know. The powerlessness of using, the unmanageability of using, you know, there is step one. And the result of doing step one for me at the beginning, okay, and was for quite a few months, was about stopping using, was about putting down the drugs. Now, I know our first step talks about being powerless over our addiction, okay, and thank God for that, You know what I mean? Thank God for that, because I think much respect as I have for the plumbers, you know what I mean, whose first step is slightly different to ours, I think we get right to the nub of the matter and we talk about being powerless over the illness as opposed to powerless over the drug itself. Because I honestly believe these days that the drug is a symptom of the illness of addiction. But I don't know where I was going with that now, it doesn't matter. But, I was talking about step one. And yes, I was talking about the importance of staying clean and the importance of step one in terms of being drugs. And what I had to do when I first came around, I had to get clean. That's what I had to do. I had to get used to being clean. It was such an alien thing for me. I'd forgotten how to live like a human being. You know, I looked terrible. I was very, very unhealthy. I was unemployable. Relationships, well, you know, what was a relationship, you know? Well, I'm not just talking about relationships, intimate relationships. I think that's one of the things I think is quite funny about NA when people talk about no relationships in early recovery. That always makes me laugh. You know what I mean? No relationships in early recovery. I think it shows how immature we are sometimes when we talk about no relationships in early recovery, you know? Because the only thing we can think of in our mind is intimate sexual relationships. But actually, I have relationships with my sponsor. I have beginning to have relationships with my family again, people at work, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't believe in that one. I believe we should be getting into relationships. And like anything in early recovery, that's bloody difficult. I didn't know how to do that stuff. I had to start somewhere, you know. So I came into recovery that was all about getting clean. And like you were saying, Fred, it was meetings, meetings, meetings when I first got clean, because like, so I wasn't going to do the steps. And in terms of step two, that was another one that came over the horizon. It didn't matter that I wasn't working the steps. The steps started working me, you know. And step two, if you said to me, you know, again, why are you at this meeting? Well, this miracle has happened in my life. You know what I mean? I don't mean it in any kind of religious sense, but this miracle has happened in my life where everything else has failed. I come to these strange meetings, you know, sometimes two or three times a day. I come to these strange meetings. This miracle has happened. I seem to have stopped using. Here is a power greater than myself that is restoring me to sanity. And I can get on board with that. I often hear people use the word God in step two, but I can't find the word God in step two. Can't find the word higher power in step two either. I can find a power greater than myself. And I am living proof that there is a power greater than myself, because the impossible has happened and I'm clean. So again, nice and simple for step two. You know what I mean? And that was so important for me for the God thing in step three. Because like I said, I didn't want to know God, but so I was left with the emptiness of step one. You know what I mean? I stopped using, my whole life revolved around the getting and using of drugs. I put the drugs down and suddenly 98% of me was empty. 98% of me had gone, because that was all I had in my life, and I was like a 2% hollow man, you know? And then in step three, we're talking about this God character, but in step two, we have this kind of stepping stone. I can believe in a power greater than myself, because I am proof that there is a power greater than myself. And by this time now, I've been around for a few months. So I've been around 4 or 5 months by this time. I've got myself a sponsor now, and we're beginning to look at the steps, you know. And I'm looking at you guys, and you haven't bullshitted me with anything you've told me about early recovery. You know, everything you've said has been good. You know, keep coming back, life's going to improve, and slowly things, well, actually quite quickly, good things got better physically. I put on a lot of weight. Quite quickly, things got better mentally. I lost the physical compulsion to use drugs. I lost the mental obsession to use drugs, you know. So I'd grown to trust you guys and what you'd said. And you were also telling me about this God character. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking, well, if you haven't bullshitted me so far about that, maybe there is something to do with the God character. And the other thing I quite liked is that you would use the word God and fuck in the same sentence. And that really appealed to me. You know what I mean? I like that kind of grounded attitude that you had about that stuff, you know. So I started looking at step three, you know, and that's when my steps took off, really, in terms of my recovery. By then, I had beginning to sort of get back into looking after myself, like I said, you know. By this time, I was beginning to realize that this was more than just a physical illness, more than just a mental illness. The mental obsession to use left me after about 3 weeks. Now, I would have sold my soul to the devil to have had the mental obsession to use drugs taken from me. And for me, that was gone after about 3 weeks. It's not to say I didn't feel like using from time to time. I did. I felt like using very strongly from time to time. But you guys know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about that obsession to use, that monkey on your shoulder, which I'd never thought I could get away from before. The last time I felt like using like that, I had the obsession to use, there was somebody that owed me some money, owed me $150, and that was enough for half a gram. And I had it on me, you know what I mean? I was about 3 or 4 weeks clean and it was on me. I was going to use, you know what I mean? You know what it's like when it hits you and there was nothing that was going to stop it. But the only thing was this guy who was normally in at 6 o'clock wasn't in until 10 o'clock that evening, okay? And opposite where this guy lived was a meeting, the Paddington meeting in Sydney. And I went across to that meeting and I was just sort of to hang out and just wait until 10 o'clock when I can go and score. And I didn't hear anything in the meeting. I didn't listen to the meeting. It was just on me the whole time. And the meeting finished, and I was off out the door. And as I was going out the door, just as I was about to go out the door, this woman stopped me and she said, "Are you all right, Harry?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah." You know, of course, I wasn't going to tell her I was going to use. So, "Yeah, of course I'm all right. Everything's fine." And she said, "How long have you been clean for?" I said, 3 weeks. And she said, "You know what?" She said, "I felt like using after 3 weeks." You know, and I said, "Well, you know what, Seville?" I said, "That's exactly what I'm going to do." I said, "It's on me. I'm going to use." I said, "I don't know why." She said, "You know why you feel like using? Because you're an addict, Harry." And we sat there and we talked for about half an hour. And this woman shared her experience with me. And I said, "Right, I'm off to use now." And as I walked through the door, I realized for the first time in my life that obsession to use had left me. Because I'd actually done something and talked about it. It was just that split decision. Do I talk to her? Don't I talk to her? Talk to her. Did something that was suggested. It left me. And I took a set of works that were in my car, I threw them out the window because I didn't want to have the paraphernalia on me. It's probably some poor little addict going around at the moment now in Australia saying, "I don't know, you're never going to believe this." You know? I started using this bloke. This bloke just threw a set of works at me. Or a fit, as we used to call them. This way. So that was the last time I felt like using it. That was the last time I'd not felt like using it. The last time I had an obsession to use. You know, so it left me free to kind of like, and that once that obsession to use had left me, it was gave me such a so much more freedom in recovery to look at my recovery and to decide what I'm going to do and where I'm going to go. You know, so step three came up. You know, and my understanding of step three, I love step three. It's the step that I use probably most use out of any step these days. I love it. I really do. Considering that I didn't want anything to do with it, you know what I mean. And again, with the steps, another thing I find quite interesting with the steps, when I got clean, we had a paperback version of the basic text. You know, the pamphlet, Who is an Addict, didn't have 30 questions. It had 136 questions in, of which one of the questions was, do you sharpen your needle on a matchbox? Doesn't everybody, I thought, you know what I mean? They've changed that literature now, you know what I mean? But that's what we got clean with. You know, we got clean with this basic text, like I said, which is the paperback. There was no stories in the back or anything. It was a third edition revised, and that was it. Now, sometimes with the amount of literature we have today, you would think that we couldn't get clean, but we got clean in our thousands and thousands, you know, at that time. Because I still believe that at the basis of our recovery lies the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. You know, I believe it was without parallel, it says, and that is my experience, you know. So we talked about the steps. Like, you know, and the steps are a set of tools. If I have a tool lying here on the table, we can sit here and we can talk about it till we're blue in the face. We can read about it. We can get our step working guides out. We can write it. You know what I mean? And our sponsor can give us a gold star and say, there we go. And you know one thing that freezes my blood is when I hear people say, I finished my step two. You know what I mean? Christ alive. You know what I mean? Finished your step two. You know what I mean? At some point, you're going to have to pick that tool up and use it. You know what I mean? This is not an academic exercise, thank heavens for that. You know, it is not an academic exercise. And whilst I believe in the power of writing, I'm not nothing against that, you know what I mean? I think we need to get away from that. It's preparing us to do these steps, you know, it's preparing us to use these tools. So, and sometimes there's so much written, so much said, I think we get, in my opinion, and I've done this myself, so I'm not, you know, but as I've got on in recovery, I've gone back and looked at how simple the steps are. And that I've actually gone back to looking at what the actual step says. So when you read about step three, there's an awful lot of stuff in there, and fair enough, a lot of it's very useful and what have you, but sometimes we need to go back and look at what that step says. You know, we made a decision to turn our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. Again, I listen to people talking about it. I think they talk about step 11. They talk about God's will. I can't find God's will in that step. You know, so I break it up into little bite-sized chunks. The big one for me is the God as we understand him, you know what I mean? Or God as I understand God, which I didn't really at the beginning, but I needed to start to develop a relationship with this God-type character because I noticed that it happened fairly he appeared several times in the steps ahead, so I needed to start to develop a relationship with that God. And like any relationship, I didn't just say, I'm going to get into this relationship and suddenly it's going to be fantastic. It's taken a lot of time, and this step has been fundamental in my understanding of God. Because what am I going to do with this God? Well, I'm going to take, you know, I'm making a decision. And the other thing I love about our set's got the word we sort of every step apart from the last one. We. A small word, you know what I mean, but it's important. Every time we work these steps, we look at the steps, it's not doing it by ourselves, we are doing it together. You know, this is a we program, not an I program. You know, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives. What's that mean, our will and our lives? Well, and what I like about you, Fred, is you talked about your life. You know, you talked about some of the stuff in your life rather than some kind of academic kind of thing about the steps. And so things that make up my will and my life. I'll talk about just a little bit about my will at the moment. I am lucky to have had kids in recovery, talking with Ollie. Ollie's think he's very unlucky at the moment because his kid's only a month year old and it's keeping him awake all night. But I'm lucky enough to have kids in recovery. You know, I've got a daughter who's 28 and a son who's 25 now. And I had them when I was clean. And me and their mum broke up and she went back to Australia. I was back here in the UK. Obviously, I came back to the UK. I got deported from Australia back to the UK, but that's another story. Yeah. I thought it was always the other way, but you know. But no, they deported me from Australia. But anyhow, I got deported from Australia. We ended up having kids here. And when we broke up, the kids went back to live with their mum in Australia. And my daughter decided that she wanted to come back and live with me. So my daughter came back to live with me when she was about 14 years old. You've got all that to come, Ollie, believe me. I'll tell you what, daughters at 14 years old, just unbelievable. You know what I mean? Oh, dear, oh, dear. That was like a whirlwind in my life. That was probably the most difficult time in my recovery. You know what I mean? I'm like 17 years old and my daughter's living in a squat and she's just using drugs and I think she's got this program and the rest of it, but this is just going on. Anyhow, my daughter's come through all that and she's a lovely girl now. And I've got a granddaughter. And any of you can come up and ask me afterwards, and I'll show you pictures of my granddaughter and my daughter. But anyhow, I've got this beautiful granddaughter now. We get on like a house on fire. We get on really, really well, and have been getting on was one of the great things in recovery, okay? They're going back to Australia to live, you know? And my son lives in Sydney, and my daughter and granddaughter are going back to live in Australia. And I think it's a great idea for them. I think it's a fantastic country. I really do. I can understand why they're going back, but it's crippling me. You know what I mean? It cripples me as a dad who gets on well with a daughter. I know that they feel the same way. It's a difficult decision for us. And I have a decision to make. You know, I have a decision to make about whether I try and get back to Australia because it's been long enough for them to have forgotten me. Or if I go back to Australia, then my partner who lives over here, that relationship is not going to survive. We have a long distance relationship of 170 miles and that survives that, you know what I mean? But it's not going to survive 12,000 miles. So sometimes in recovery, we have these decisions that we have to make and they're just fuckers. You know what I mean? There is no right decision there. What is right and what is wrong? So eventually I think I have made the decision, but eventually I'm going to need to make that decision about what I'm going to do, where I'm going to go. And when I make that decision, that is part of my will, okay? I'm going to say, I want to do this, okay? I might be talking about a job. I might want to change a job. That is my will about what I want to do. I might want to come out of a relationship, go into another relationship. That is my will. That is what I believe is my will. My life is my kids, for example. It might be my job. It might be the people around me, the relationships I have with my family. That is my life. And I've got this. So I'm making a decision to turn my will and my life, okay? And then there's the God character over there. And then the most important part of this step for me is turning it over to the care of my higher power. Because there is no right answer to that, what I need to do. So what I'm doing is I'm making this decision. I'm saying to the God of my understanding, take care of me. You know, there is step three in action. Take care of me. You know, take care of this decision I'm making. And sometimes I can make decisions in my life. I do know some decisions are right and some are wrong. And I make the wrong decision. Because I'm not very good at step 11. I still do what I want to do a lot of the time. I say to God, take care of me. So it happens so often in my life where I say, God, take care of me. Here's my will of my life. Take care of it. And you know what? If I've got money troubles, the sort of God that I have doesn't. I don't find 10 quid on the ground and say, oh, that must be God. Look, you know. I'm not sure, as the great Nick Cave once said, that I believe in an interventionist God. I'm not sure I believe in an interventionist God like that, okay? If there was an interventionist God, then West Ham would be top of the Premiership, I'll tell you that now. So I'm not sure I believe in that, but I believe in a God of grace, as it were, okay? And it's like a bumper car with one of those things that goes up into the onto the power, you know, goes into the darkness. You see the sparks going. And that's what I feel my higher power is like. I can't describe it, which I'm pleased I can't. It wouldn't be much of a God if I could sit here and talk about it. I don't understand how it works. But I believe that I get grace in my life today. And whilst things don't turn out right all the time, that's not what the purpose of this thing is for. What is happening is that I am looked after. And I've been looked after through some pretty bad times in my recovery. You know, so the beauty of that is in step three is I'm beginning to develop this relationship with the God of my understanding. And I do that on a daily, I try and do that. I say I do that on a daily basis. I try and do that on a daily basis in any case, you know. Always, you know what it's like. Always when things are going well, it kind of takes a back seat, doesn't it? Until you get your SOS God. Oi, you know what I mean? I need your help again, you know. Having trouble here, you know what I mean? So, yes, and you know, and then getting clean and staying clean for a while, getting used to that. After being clean, for me, it was about 14, 15 months after being clean. It was kind of my head came up and I realized that the promise of Narcotics Anonymous, which was freedom from active addiction, had happened for me. You know what I mean? I knew that I was going to stay clean today, not because I was being big-headed, but because I was doing what they said. Steps, meetings, or I believe meetings first and foremost, steps, service, sponsorship. Do these things, you will stay clean. And I'm, like I said, living proof that that's what's happened. So once I got used to that, I thought, fuck, now what do I want to do? You know, up comes my head, where do I want to go? What do I want to be? And a good sponsor at the time, he said, Harry, you know, it's time for step four and five. I did my step four and five, listen, you can hear my enthusiasm for recovery. I'd quite happy sit here and talk for another 40 minutes on the other steps, but you'd be pleased to hear I'm not going to. But step four and five were really good for me, you know what I mean? They were the next chapter of my recovery, and I needed to do a good step four and five. I didn't need to rush through it at the beginning. Beauty of Narcotics Anonymous, everything in Narcotics Anonymous says take your time. We didn't become addicted overnight, so remember, easy does it. When we take that and look at step six, the opening words of step six, I'm not sure whether they're verbatim, it's about not rushing, you know, take your time. So many times as addicts, we've sought the rewards of the hard work without the hard labor. You know what I mean? And that's what we want to do. We just want to rush around saying, I'm sorry to everybody, which is what we want to do. So I'm sorry, never going to do it again, which we've done all through our lives. You know what I mean? Making direct amends has got very, very little to do with saying I'm sorry. If I want to make direct amends to people, you know, one of my biggest character defects is anger. You know what I mean? It comes up, it's volcanic, and then it goes down again, and it stays dormant for a while, and then it builds up and it comes up again, you know. Was always involved in violence when I'm using, haven't been involved in violence when I'm clean, but I can still be very intimidating. Look at the size of me, you know, with my voice and my actions, I can intimidate people. Hated about myself, but that has improved quite a long way. You know what I mean? That anger has improved quite a long way. But that for me is kind of like, you know, that's my step six and seven. Now, if I'm angry with my daughter, for example, like I have been from time to time, and I go overboard with that anger, 5 minutes, all right, yes, and I go overboard with that anger, then I need to do something about it. I need to make amends. And I can say I'm sorry, and then she'll say, but it'll happen again, Dad. You know what I mean? So rather than crow about it, what I need to do is a proper step six and seven. You know what I mean? I need to look at my anger. I need to go to this God character again. I need to realize I'm powerless over my anger. Again, I'm powerless over my character defects. If I wasn't powerless over my character defects, then why would I need God to remove them? Why would I humbly ask him to remove where I come up short? You know what I mean? Because I have no power over it. I sometimes, when I get into the anger, I look at myself and I realize that it's just kind of, I'm out of control, you know? And I'm 33 years clean, you know? I need to do something about it. And if I'm gonna look at my character defects, I need to make sure I'm doing my step four and five properly. So, like I said, I'm not gonna talk to you. I've got a 4 minute warning now. So I'll just begin to wrap up. I mean, I love this program. I love where it's taken me. I love the, and you know, the thing that I like most about this program, I think, you know, is the fact that, what it represents to me, what I love about recovery more than anything else, and recovery is just another word for life, really, isn't it? Life on life's own terms. And like you were saying, Fred was talking about some hurt in his life. You can't go through recovery for 10 years, you know, 33 years, what have you, without having shit going on in your life. You know what I mean? I've had people die in my life. My sister died of this illness, funnily enough. My dad didn't, but he died. You know, my relationship of 16 years split up, you know. I found myself in hospital very close to death with a pulmonary embolism at one stage, came round, found the priest sitting at the end of the bed. These things are not fun. You know what I mean? And they don't seem fair. But you know what I love about recovery? It's not that those things happen, because shit's going to happen in your life. We have life back on life's own terms. What I like about it, about recovery today, is that I have the ability to man up to that stuff. So when my dad died, I was able to take the reins. I was able to comfort my mum, comfort the family, help organise the funeral and stuff like that. So whilst I didn't like the fact that my dad died, I liked the fact that I could be there and I could do that for him. You know, so that's what I like about it. But you know, the thing I like most about recovery is freedom, the freedom to make my choices in recovery, to go where I want in recovery. You know, the only addicts I've ever seen who are kind of clones are the addicts who first come into the rooms, the ones who are on a mission. You know the ones I'm talking about, you know what I mean? Just like I was when I first came around. You know, we all do the same thing. We come into the rooms, we blossom as human beings, we blossom as individuals, as characters. And you know what I want to do, where I wanted to go with my life. Listen, I'm a high-rise window cleaner. That's my job at 33 years clean. You know what I mean? I love it. I love getting up in the morning. I love going to do that stuff. I'm never going to be a millionaire, but it paid enough money for me to go to the World Convention. I like my traveling. That's what I like to do. Other people want to come in, they want to get a business, they want to make a lot of money. Whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. Because ultimately, your journey, if it's anything like my journey or anything like the journeys I've seen with other people, at some point, whatever you're after, you think you're after, you're going to find in recovery again that it's a lie again. You know what I mean? That it doesn't matter how much you put on the outside with the relationships, with all that stuff on the outside, it doesn't matter how much of that stuff, you still have to address the inside. This is not a moral dilemma we suffer from. This is a spiritual malaise. I believe that from the bottom of my heart. And like I said, I love that freedom. I'm privileged enough to do service in prisons up in, you know, around our area up in Norwich, you know. And I go into those prisons, and some of those prisons, they have the wrapped unit, they have treatment centres in there, and they're clean. And those guys, who are some of them doing very long stretches, tell me that they have more freedom being clean inside prison than they do using on the outside. And I understand that, you know what I mean? I understand exactly what they're talking about, because I was in that self-made prison. So I've got my life back, I've got my sanity back a lot of the time, but more than anything, I've got my freedom back, and I love it. Thanks for asking me to share.